Before we get started on today's podcast, I want to remind you that the DVD of my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest, is now available. Go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com, click on the videos page. You'll see it front and center. It'll be at the top of the list. Just click on it. It'll take you right to PayPal and Bob's Your Uncle. I'm very proud of this documentary. I spent a lot of time on it and a lot of love on it. It's something that means a lot to me, and I hope that you will enjoy it too. Also, as you probably know, the documentary is about a parody of Beaugest that was made by students in 1939 on the same sets used by the Wellman film. And on the DVD is also the parody itself, which was shown only three times in 1940 and never shown in public again. So it's really a fun thing to see. And in the documentary, I interviewed three survivors of the cast and crew of the Lost remake, and also the documentary features appearances by Kevin Brownlow, Leonard Maltin, William Wellman Jr., whose father, of course, directed the 1939 Beaugest, and Maria Cooper Janis, whose father, Gary Cooper, was the star of that film. So I hope that you will go to thecommentarytrack.com and buy at least one copy of the DVD, and then let me know how you like it. Thanks.
Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome to episode 42 of the Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, and I want to remind you that we are all brothers in that great fraternity, the Mystic Knights of the Sea. We have a really great show for you tonight, and we'll get to that in a moment. First off, I want to thank everyone who's gone onto iTunes and left a nice review and a nice five-star rating. But as grateful as I am to each and every one of those people, there aren't enough of them. Please, I urge you, if you're listening to this and if you like it, go to iTunes and leave a good review. The only way that I can start attracting people who don't personally know me is if they start the commentary track climb on the charts at iTunes, and it becomes more prominent, so the more people will check it out. And I hope that once they check it out, they'll find that it's something they want to return to each and every week. Now, speaking of each and every week, you'll probably have noticed, if you're a regular listener, that I haven't posted anything for a couple of weeks. That is because I was in San Francisco for the San Francisco Silent Film Festival, and I had a wonderful time. I want to thank the people of the Silent Film Festival for welcoming me so nicely, and also all the people there at the Castro Theater who were so fine to me. That's a wonderful place, and I really, really enjoyed it. It was a great festival. Saw many, many good things, and talked to many great people, and those will be unreeling. I have a memory chip. It doesn't even reel. But let's just say unreeling over the next few weeks. So that's why I've been silent a little bit, but we're back now with a vengeance. As a matter of fact, I've banked nearly a dozen interviews that will be coming up, and hope that I will not fall behind again. It's, you know how it is. I'm really excited about my guest tonight. It's Trace Beaulieu. All you fans of Mystery Science Theater 3000 remember him as the evil Dr. Forrester. He's also a member of Cinematic Titanic, the group that goes around doing very similar to MST3K, being very witty and smart about movies that might not be quite up to snuff. But Trace and I had a good talk about that. He and I have known each other for a long time, although we haven't seen each other for a long time now. So it was really great to get together and relive old times a little bit and talk about movies. And I think some people might be surprised to learn of how much he loves silent movies, and because I think we tend to think of MST3K as dealing strictly in movies that might not be as good as other things. And so I even ask him that, and I feel a little sheepish about it because it's a semi-stupid question. I just wanted him to talk about whether he really loves movies or whether he just loves mocking movies. And it turns out that he really has a lot to say and a lot of affection for movies, and I think we're on the same page on a lot of this stuff. So it was really a fun conversation. Hope that you enjoyed this conversation with Trace Beaulieu, and I'll see you on the other side. Let's begin at the beginning. We met when you had already been an MST3K star, but we met on a TV show called Fast Food Films. You remember that?
I do, and we were just talking about how long ago that was.
Yeah.
15?
I believe it was 1998 and 99, as I recall. But, I mean, the pilot, I guess, was 98.
Yeah, that was the pilot. That was Josh Weinstein and Paul Feig,
mm-hmm.
who was
who disappeared.
Just disappeared, yeah. And, mm-hmm. It's funny, this is a fast food film reunion weekend. Josh and I and Joel Hodgson just did a commentary track for Paul's film The Heat with Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy, a comedy, which is usually we don't riff on comedies,
mm-hmm.
Or good films,
sure,
or films where the director is in the room with us, and we broke every rule this time. But it was a great deal of fun to do, and it's a great movie, very funny, really funny movie. And so we... It's a commentary track that'll be on the Blu-ray.
Oh, terrific. And you did it the same way you've always done? You just watched and talked, or did you write script, or how do you do?
Yeah, we all watched the film a couple of times and made notes, but it wasn't heavily scripted. It was more conversational, and we talked over the film. We didn't necessarily have a chance to wait for those gaping holes that are usually in the films that we do a treatment to.
Yeah, Robot Monster has space, but a film like this does not particularly have a lot of space, right?
No, modern films, they kind of learned how to make them, and they don't leave those giant...
or did they?
Well, yeah, that's true, that's true. What else is that? We should have done Lone Ranger, you know? Not to say anything bad about the Lone Ranger.
Well, of course not, no. I have not seen that yet. You know, I helped Clayton Moore, the real Lone Ranger, write his autobiography.
Oh, that's right. So, yeah, exactly.
And my wife is an artist and has often found herself at shows with Michael Horse and his wife. And Michael Horse played Tonto in the film version from the 80s that took Clayton's mask away from him.
Oh, that's
so
right.
Every time we saw him, he used to say, next time you see Clayton, please apologize. Please tell him how sorry I am. So I don't know if Johnny Depp would feel the same way about apologizing to Clayton if he had the chance.
Didn't Clayton Moore have to wear, like, sunglasses? Didn't he do some kind of version of the mask?
He just wore wraparound sunglasses. They just told him he could not present himself as the Lone Ranger. They didn't particularly mind if he presented himself as the man who used to play the Lone Ranger.
Yeah.
But he had to take away the mask. But there was a huge groundswell against the Rather Corporation. And, in fact, there was a petition with a million names on it telling them to give him back the mask. And they did.
They gave him back the mask.
Yeah, and they apologized, and they said...
What was the reason for not letting him be the Lone Ranger?
They thought that since they were creating a new Lone Ranger, that it was time for him to stop pretending to be the Lone Ranger and for the new guy to take on the mantle. And so that's what...
I don't even remember the new guy.
Nobody does. And I've got a great story about him, which I can only tell you off mic.
Okay.
But I'll do that. Now, the issue of bad films, which has been a major part of your professional life in dealing with bad movies in a way. So I was curious, and we never talked about this before, although, I mean, God knows, we haven't seen each other in years. But I don't remember ever talking about this back in Fast Food Films days,
that, is that really a, is that just the way things fell out? Or do you prefer bad movies to good movies? Do you, are you a real movie buff? Do you like, you know, I mean, do you have a good solid love of
Oh, absolutely. And even these bad movies, we love these bad movies. I speak for myself.
Sure.
I mean, you live with them long enough and you go, oh, I don't know if it's love anymore. But you can't spend that much time with a film if you don't have some affection for
sure.
it. And a lot of these films that we revisited, we saw as kids. You know, Saturday afternoon or the local creature feature, midnight movies. So there's a fondness for these films. I still watch. I just watched without any prompting, and no one was forcing me to do it. But I watched Angry Red Planet, which we had done with Cinematic Titanic. We had done a film called Doomsday Machine, and Stanley Cortez was the
cinematographer?
Yes, cinematographer on that. And I noticed he was also the cinematographer on Angry Red Planet. I go, I had never seen that film before, which is unusual because, you know, spending so much, like you say, of my professional life and just sitting at home in front of the TV, why had I never seen this film? And now I know. But I like those science fiction movies. Where there's, you know, there's the engineering guy or the electronics guy who's the goofball, who's the comic relief. There's always a babe, and then there's always a guy on the make. And it's like, what space program put this these people together?
And a lot of smoking in the capsule, too.
Yeah. And then I was thinking about it. It was like, these films are still being made. Prometheus is exactly one of those
sure.
movies from the 50s. It doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
People behave stupidly. And it just looks better.
Yeah.
The props and special effects are better.
Yeah.
But I really like Prometheus because it's got tinsel. It's got stupid stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a robot kind of guy.
We're still in a phase of history where people are unduly impressed by special effects. And they really think that because the special effects are better, that the movie is better.
Yeah.
But I contend that that's not the case.
No. So you go back, I just watched Lawrence of Arabia. There's not a speck of CGI that movie. They are, when you see hundreds of guys, when the camera comes up over the rocks and you see hundreds of guys in the desert, there's hundreds of guys.
Yeah.
They're riding camels. And it's not, you know, some Jar Jar Binks kind of thing.
No.
And we'll never see those movies made again.
No, we never will, unfortunately. But it, you know, I think, when you read reviews from the, say, the late 50s, early 60s of these big, giant, epic films like Cleopatra, that kind of thing, they almost always got panned. But I think if those same films were released today, people would be so impressed by them.
Yeah.
Because I think people are just used to that.
Yeah.
But you look at something like Cleopatra, which I'm not going to defend more than this, but it's huge. And
yeah.
it's just... It never stops taking your breath away with just how many people there are and how big the sets are and all that stuff. It's just amazing.
Yeah. And well, and then keep going back in time, you know, Intolerance or, you know, those films, you watch them today and they're still staggering.
Sure.
Ben-Hur is still like, those are real people doing that.
We went to the, Last Remaining Seats Festival. Do you know that?
No.
It's the downtown theaters that are mostly not used as theaters anymore, but the huge, like, palace theaters. Once a year, they have a summer series, and they show movies in them, and we saw the 1925 Ben-Hur just 2 weeks ago, I think. And I hadn't seen it in a while, especially in 35mm. And, yeah, it's unbelievable how many people there are. The huge battle on the sea
yeah.
are real ships.
Yeah.
and you watch the 1959 Heston one, and there are all these model ships in front of a backdrop and everything. Yeah. And but you look at this 1925 one, and it's just this incredible battle scene with just hundreds of people on every ship,
yeah,
on every single one. Yeah. It's just amazing.
The organization for that is just stunning. It just, but I'm very jealous of you because you've met one of my heroes, Kevin Brownlow.
Ah,
well, you're great friends with him.
Yeah.
His series, The Pioneers, Hollywood, The Pioneers, was so influential to me. Well, I realized once I moved to Los Angeles, I'd fallen into love with a Hollywood that hadn't existed for 100 years.
Sure.
But that's my absolute favorite documentary of show business. And his time capsule to capture those people who,
yeah,
he got them at exactly the right time. I guess late 70s.
Some of those were early 70s. Yeah. The interviews spanned quite a bit of time. I think the series first aired in 1979.
Yeah.
But I think he had done for probably the better part of a decade before that, had been interviewing people along the way. So, yeah, he got amazing. I mean, he's got Louise Brooks is in this thing.
Yeah.
In addition to, of course, Lillian Gish and Viola Dana and all these people. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
Alan Dwan.
I've got the set on
VHS. So I'm jealous of him. Man, oh, man.
Yeah, to get that. But to archive those people, just he should be knighted knighted in the film industry.
Well, at least they finally gave him the honorary Oscar. So that was a very cool thing. And I got stories about that, too, because we went down to the desert the very next day. He got his honorary Oscar one night. The next day, he and I were in a dune buggy in the California desert near Yuma. And until you've seen Kevin Brownlow in a dune buggy, you haven't lived. So were you became interested in silent films as a result of that?
Yeah. That just sparked my interest. I mean, it's such a romantic look at that era. And the music, too, is
sure,
so powerful.
I also have an episode with Carl Davis, so listen to that.
I'm going to do that. I saw it out everything I could on that series. It showed in Minneapolis at the time. It was like late night somehow.
Yeah.
On it must have been syndicated to local stations. And then after I saw it, I just happened to stumble into the at the Royal Albert Hall in England. They had display. They had what do they call it in a museum?
An exhibit.
An exhibit. That's a better word. And
or
it was
display.
Like, it was connected to the Thames television production of that. So
wow.
It was like, and then I came home after being in Europe for a little while, and then found the record album. I still have all this stuff. I have the VHS, the record album, the book that accompanied the series,
mm-hmm,
and then the program from that museum exhibit on art direction.
Wow.
Which I still have, which, you know, I'd all found these later, you know, in later years. And then, you know, his other documentaries on Chaplin and Keaton and just amazing
yeah,
stuff.
The Unknown Chaplin series is astonishing. It's just for all of that footage that he found of outtakes and repeated takes.
Yeah.
You know, you see him trying to get Virginia Cheryl to hold up the flower in just the right way in City Lights, and she just can't do it the way he wants her to do it. And he films it, you know, 100 times or something.
Yeah.
And it just goes on and on and on.
There's another couple of books that I loved. Kevin Bankston.
John Bankston.
Where he finds those locations where those films are shot. It's just stunning.
Yeah, he's my hero. I love He's been on the podcast as well. And I'm going to see him next week, I hope. I just never get tired of looking through his website, and I have all three of the books that he put out. And that stuff fascinates me.
Yeah. It's archaeology. It's just one of the first things a friend of mine showed me when I moved to Los Angeles was the steps where Laurel and Hardy take the piano up. They're still there. And, you know, maybe other people don't care, but it was like, you're kidding. That's still here? That's so awesome.
I deeply care about that kind of stuff. In fact, when we're in San Francisco next week for the Silent Film Festival, which will be last week by the time you hear this.
So don't call in.
Yes. Yes. Don't hold your calls. We're staying in the same bed and breakfast that Kevin stayed in for the Napoleon thing last year. And it's a block away. As a matter of fact, right after the interview, we went to lunch. John Bengtson and my wife and Kevin and I went to lunch. And Kevin said, oh, let's take a detour. It's only a block away. And it was the dentist office from McTeague from the film Greed. And it's just a block away, and there it is, and the building looks exactly like it looked in Greed, except it doesn't have a big gold tooth hanging outside. But just stuff like that, and I go nuts about those kind of things. I love that.
I do too. I just am thrilled that these guys are so dedicated to preserve all of that information. Right. It just... So, I mean, kind of meandered around your question about do I like movies, and I kind of do. Every genre and some not so much, but I am a voracious watcher. Maybe not all good films, but with Netflix, for an insomniac, Netflix is awesome. And I get to see a lot of bad stuff.
And good is pretty variable. I mean, it's subjective.
Yeah.
And I've always contended that, let's say, a film like Plan 9 from Outer Space, which people keep calling the worst movie ever made.
No.
It's not. No. I mean, it's really, you can't have that much fun watching something if it's bad.
And it's it's incompetent.
No, not at all. I always think about it's razor sharp focus. I mean, the camera's always set up in the right place.
Black and white looks good.
Yeah.
The music is good.
Mm-hmm.
It's shot better than maybe 80% of the Mystery Science Theater movies we did.
Yeah.
The sound is good. It's synced. It's not a bad movie by the standards that we established later with films like Manos.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've done that film. We've done live riffing of that one with Dana Gould and Frank Conniff and Josh and I several times now, and that's been a great deal of fun because Dana Gould has a relationship with that film because he was friends with Myla Nurmi later in her life. He was paying her electric bills and things like
that. Yeah.
So he's got a story to tell, backstory about the film. And then we've approached that one by just doing a live riff without script. So it's a very electric and dangerous, more so.
When you do a film like that, which you've done a lot of times, how much do you find a good bit and stick with it, or do you try to always come at it fresh?
Well, that film we did three times with Dana, and we talked about how we were going to approach it. Since we weren't going to be scripted, we didn't want to walk over each other. So we kind of we did go through the film and go, okay, I got a bit for this and I got a bit for that. But otherwise, you fill in, and not to be too pretentious, but it's a little bit like more jazz, where you have to listen to each other and you kind of anticipate someone's got something. I found it very refreshing and exciting to do it after we'd done so many scripted, versions of films. But yeah, you find things that work and you go, well, no, that's where that goes. That worked really well. I got a good laugh there. So let's stay there.
On the show that I worked on that got me the fast food films gig, it was a show called Real Wild Cinema. And it was hosted by Sandra Bernhard. And she had a they would show clips from bad movies or cheap movies or B movies or what have you, but they would always have a guest. And so there were some remarkable, I mean, Roger Corman and Russ Meyer and all these people would be guests on the show. So I would have to do a pre-interview. And we had Myla Nurmi on. And so I had to do a pre-interview with her to then give my notes to Sandra. And all I remember about that basically was that we had to set up a time for me to call her because she had to go to somebody's house to take the phone call. And
because Dana hadn't paid her bill that week.
Well, I said something along the lines of, oh, is your phone disconnected or something like that? And she said, yes, I had to disconnect it because James Dean keeps calling me and he calls repeatedly and it's driving me crazy. And I said, well, I can see your point. That was my Myla Nurmi experience.
She was a character. Dana's got some great stories.
Yeah. I never got to meet her in person. I was sorry about that. I just talked to her on the phone. And every once in a while I would try to talk like James Dean just to freak her out.
There's a lot of fiction going on in her story, too.
I would imagine. Well, the reason I ask you the question to begin with, which is, you know, the more I think about it, is a weird question. Do you like good movies, or do you only... But I guess what that's born of is that I was wondering, did you come at MST and Cinematic Titanic strictly as a comedian or as a movie guy who liked to comment on films? Because I didn't know if it was simply a vehicle for comedy or if it was something more than that.
I think initially it was comedy. You know, we were certainly all steeped in those movies. It was a different movie viewing experience for us when we were kids because there was no VHS. We had to remember what happened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after a while you see the films over and over on a Saturday. The local television stations would just start rerunning these things like crazy because they only had maybe four monster movies.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, great, it's the Bat again. I'm so sick of the Bat. Where's Frankenstein? Let me see Frankenstein. But yeah, I think comedy, first off, you know, when we started doing Mystery Science Theater, we were doing it without having seen the film before. And at KTMA, they would show the films to us as in real time, and we would comment on them without a script. We had to improv it all because there was no money. They were also cutting the show together as we taped it. So we'd tape the host segments. They'd go all into the edit bay, and then we'd go to lunch, and they'd put those together, and then in the afternoon we'd do the movie segments. By the end of the day, they had the show done.
Wow.
wasn't always good, but, you know, and we were all doing stand-up comedy, so it was more, you know, a little competitive, trying to get jokes out and top one another or add to one another. And so I'd say comedically that was the initial drive and goal, was to make a funny show. The film, you know, stuff kind of started sticking to it. The more film history, and as like Frank joined us, and Frank Conniff is completely immersed in all aspects of show business. He knows everything about show business, which is a great asset to have. And everybody who came into it, all the writers, brought something different or a different perspective. Colleen Henjam was a writer for a while. She's a jazz singer and a painter. So she came in with a completely different set of tools than what we had. You know, we're making fun of pop culture cartoons and, you know, cereal commercials and things like that. So when it was at its peak, we had a lot of eclectic contributors. So it's, you know, you just see us on screen, but there was a whole bunch of people responsible for making that.
I think that's
the depth that it had.
One of the reasons that it was so highly regarded, at least in our house, why it's so highly regarded, is because it was so smart. It could be smart and silly at the same time. And that's not an easy tightrope to walk.
Yeah, and it's a real compliment to the show and to the writers. Because we all had different parts of the puzzle to bring in. So it, I think there was even some of the guys that went on to work on The Onion wrote for us for a while. We had a program where you'd watch it at home and submit your tape and script, and then one of us in the writing room would go through that and pick out the jokes. So we had a lot of people writing on that.
You would have to. That's a lot of time, because you never cut the films, did you?
We would for to fit around commercials and that kind of thing. Some a lot, some not so much. Some were too short, and we had to put those short subjects in.
Yeah.
To I was going to say pad it out, but oh sure, pad. It's a pad.
To add more goodness.
Yeah, more goodness. I like that.
Now the puppets, they came from Joel. That was his idea?
Yeah, Joel built them originally. The show was going to be he and these companions trapped in space and just watching a movie. It would be like you'd be, viewing it with somebody else, at home. And as things got rolling, we found a need to comment a lot just to entertain ourselves. And so it was an evolution of the show. It didn't start off, we're going to make a lot of pop cultural references about these movies, and it was more organic than that.
Now, you went on after Mystery Science Theater 3000. When did you start with America's Funniest Home Videos?
I left Mystery Science in 96, I think, and came out to L.A. in 97. And reacquainted myself with Josh. We hadn't, spoken for a while. He'd moved out to L.A. And I needed to get some kind of recording device. And I knew Josh had that kind of stuff. He had a band, and he was always more proficient with that technology. So I knew there was like a thing called a four-track machine. Mm-hmm. And I needed a four-track because I had to record an audition for Jar Jar Binks. My agent got me the pages to read for this character. And this is way before anyone knew what that was going to be. So I had to record this myself, and I got in touch with Josh, and he was just being brought in as the head writer of the sort of revitalized America's Funniest Home Videos. Saget had gone, and they were trying to bring a more kind of younger and hipper vibe to it. They had John Fugelsang as a host. He'd been I think MTV or VH1.
Yeah, I think
host.
VH1.
And then Daisy Fuentes, who was host in Latin America somewhere. I don't know. So Josh was brought in as head writer, and he knew that I was around, and he knew that I could make fun of videos that we'd done a lot of, and he brought me in as a writer. And I think I did 9 seasons there.
That's amazing.
Of all, it was great. It was a fantastic, run to have in Los Angeles, to have a job that long. And it was a great environment. It was really fun. And that show is still chugging along. Not even chugging. It's a bullet train.
Yeah.
25 years,
I think? It'll probably never stop. There's no reason for it to.
No. And it's such a good family show. That's the feedback I get when we go out on the road and we meet people and they go, oh, it's family hour. We can watch it with the kids.
I must say, and this has always been the case, I've never watched that show without belly laughing at least one time, and often throughout the show. because it is genuinely a funny show.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people somehow think that it's some sort of lowbrow.
Yeah.
But I have never watched it without laughing, and laughing a lot.
I got a lot of guff from people who were on, like, network shows, yeah. Friends of mine's working, and they go, oh, you got to get on a real show. And I go, well, you know, I'm on a real show, and I'm getting paid real money, and, oh, you just got canceled. So maybe you need to get on a real show. And then I'd hear people would come up to me at dinner parties and stuff, and they go, oh, yeah, you're on that show. My kid loves that show. We can't leave the house until the show's over. So it was a great deal of fun, and to get that kind of feedback from people is and a little bit of money is.
Oh yeah. Well, my friend Mike Pelleschi, who I worked with on Blind Date, went over to that show. It must have been in 2000.
Yeah, he came like in after John and Daisy. It was, I think, dark for a couple seasons, and then it came back with John Bergeron.
Yeah,
and yeah, I know Mike. Spent many a lunch in the writers' room with Mike and Todd. And
Mike is a live wire, or at least he was when I knew him. I haven't seen him in a long time.
Yeah, he's
great guy.
He's done great, and I have nothing but respect and admiration and appreciation for having such a long run with that show.
9 seasons, that's really impressive. So, So at least you got your benefits taken care of, right?
That's yes.
That's what we all think about.
We do. I do like the Guild.
I was only on a Guild show one time, so it's so no benefits for me.
Ah, well. But
no, I live the eternal outsider life.
You're a rebel.
I'm a rebel, a loner. You don't get benefits from writing books about silent movies, that's for sure.
There should be an award, though. There should be something.
I'm sure I'll get the poverty award. The poorhouse prize. That'll be nice.
The Hoover flag.
Yes. So, now, beyond that, have you done a lot of just voiceover work? You said you were going in for Jar Jar Binks. Is that something that you did a lot of? Because I don't know much about that part of your career.
Well, that's once the film came out, I never really talked about it. But I did not get the part, by the way.
I
didn't get the part. Probably good that I didn't become the most hated science fiction character of all time.
But don't you think he was mostly hated because of his voice? Maybe if it had been you, there would have been a wave of affection for
him. But that was how it was written. That was exactly what I imagined he would sound like based on the text. And I was reading it, I was a little amazed. It's like, this is hearkening back to another era of, I was going to say darker era, but it was offensive on the page, and it didn't get better.
Wow.
I'm never working for Lucas again, I can tell. Or Disney. Oh, wait, yes. I did work for Disney. AFB.
There you go.
I did work for him, but... other voice work, Joel and I just did a little cameo voice work on the new Arrested Development.
Yes. How'd that come about?
The producer was a big fan of Mystery Science Theater. And, you know, they called us up and said, hey, can you do this? We said, yeah, that'd be great. So I recorded just on my iPhone in a closet a couple of lines, and through the miracle of and magic of editing and digital recording, they put it all together. They put the silhouette on a segment, and it's a very fast, if you know that show, it moves very quickly and jumps from one esoteric thing to another, but it was fun to do, and then fun to see it up, and the fans responded to that quite well.
Now, when did Cinematic Titanic get started? It seems like it was 10 years ago or so?
5 years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Time seems twice as long to me.
5 or 6 years, I guess. We started that, we thought we might be able to do more Mystery Science Theaters, and we with the rights problems and all this stuff, and the rights to the actual brand of Mystery Science Theater, which was tied up. We said, well, what else can we do? We like working together. What can we do that's similar but not the same thing? And that's where Cinematic Titanic was born. We did 6 or 7 in-studio tapings, similar to the way we did Mystery Science Theater. We did host segments and then the movie riffing. And at the same time, we were going out doing live versions. We got invited to ILM to do a live show there. They have a movie mocking club.
Mm.
And so we went up there. And then we just kept booking these live events and realized it was much more fun to do them that way. You know, being in front of a live audience was much more energizing and electric to do it. And frankly, more lucrative than making DVDs.
I can imagine. Now, were those more scripted than MST or less?
They were about the same. They were more scripted, more... since we were in front of a live audience, the jokes were much more structured. We couldn't be as... Well, we could be more eclectic, but you don't want the audience sitting there thinking. You want them laughing. So we'd try to go more for hard jokes, and I think the writing really is more focused on the joke structure with Cinematic Titanic. And Josh, I think, is largely responsible for that, of honing it and getting us on track to not quite be so, you know, referential, maybe. But we still do a lot of that stuff, too.
Well, sure.
And we still just do the, you know, we'll do a fart joke. We'll do something lowbrow, but we'll also do something highbrow. Or just outright pander.
Nothing wrong with a little pandering now and again.
Yeah.
I would almost assume that there's a little bit less material for a Cinematic Titanic because it's a live show, and you have to allow for audience reaction and
absolutely
the big laughs that come and so forth.
Yeah, the same script done 2 different nights or 2 different towns can be completely different depending on where they're laughing and at which joke, and the laugh may carry over and obscure 2 other jokes.
Yeah,
so it's going to change and fluctuate, and then there's always this factor of a joke's coming up. It hasn't worked in the past. I have to write it before I get there. And that's always a game, too. And then there's just trying to crack each other up on stage
yeah.
or think of something new that people will not expect. Even, you know, the people on stage are a little surprised. So that's why I love the live show so much more than the taped. The audience is a huge part of this.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I was in a comedy troupe for about 5 years in Chicago, and it always amazed me when we would do a set piece, and there would be a line that was always gangbusters, that I would say it, place would fall down. And then every 7 performances, nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing at all. And I would say it exactly the same way and exactly the same context. And you always thought, wow, this is how does this happen?
But yeah. That's it's a little more dangerous that way.
Yeah.
You know, here's that surefire joke, and I'm going to say it, and I'm going to bask in the warm applause. And then it's like, whoa, I'm alone, and I'm naked, yes. And that joke doesn't work.
Yes, I am loved by no one at this moment.
Yeah, I didn't say it. The great thing is there's 5 of us on stage, and if I just sucked, Frank's going to say something funny, or Mary Jo's going to say something funny, and so it's you're not left completely dangling.
Now, I guess Cinematic Titanic, now let me back up a little bit. It's seems like there was another iteration of that before Cinematic Titanic, which was making CDs to play with feature films.
That's Riff Tracks. That's
okay, that was the other guys, right?
Yeah.
Or that was
yes, we like to refer to them as the other guys.
Yeah, I've forgotten his name. Because
Mike Nelson.
Yeah, Mike Nelson.
Phil Corbett and Kevin Murphy.
Yeah.
And they do Riff Tracks, and they are doing more contemporary films, or at least initially they were, because people had the DVDs. It made sense, you know, because you sync up the MP3 of their riffing to the movie.
Yeah.
And then they have an opportunity to do stuff that's more contemporary.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about copyright. I mean, I guess that's probably the MST origin story anyways. You got things that were public domain.
Right, right.
But doing Riff Tracks, they didn't have to deal with that because they're not...
Yeah, it was a...
They're not showing a copyrighted film at all. They're just talking.
Yeah, it was a real smart workaround.
Yeah.
I think they've opened that up more, and they do like more of the shorts, the educational shorts and older films. And I think they're doing a live show in August of Starship Troopers.
Hmm.
Which I think they're going to have a hard time finding anything to say about that film.
Well... It's the audience will be taken with the gravitas of the film, and I think they'll resent any kind of
gravitas. Yeah, that's look at all the gravitas all over the place.
It's all over the place. How long were you in Los Angeles?
I lived out here for 11 years, and liked it quite a bit, and have a lot of friends out here. And had an opportunity to move back to Minnesota, and my dad was still living there, and I wanted to be closer to him.
Sure.
And it came down to needed a change of scenery, change of pace, and have not regretted moving back at all.
So you just use that as home base, but how much do you travel with Cinematic Titanic?
Boy, when we're in our season, we're like the circus. When we're on the road, we're out a couple of times a month. And we've done a lot of East Coast dates, fewer West Coast. I don't know why. But we're wrapping it up. This is our last year as Cinematic Titanic. We have dates throughout the fall. And our last one, our last show is New Year's Eve at the Keswick. In Pennsylvania.
Now, why are you stopping?
That's a good question. It's become difficult to get us all together, for one, because we're all in different states now. Frank just moved to New York. He's got a new comedy job. I don't know if I can announce it, but follow his Facebook or Twitter, and you will find out what Frank Conniff is doing. Josh is still in Los Angeles. Mary Jo's in Austin. I'm in eastern Minnesota. And Joel's in Pennsylvania.
Wow.
So it's, you know, when we started doing it, all of us except Mary Jo were in Los Angeles. So it's just been logistically difficult to keep us all together.
Yeah. Do you do it as a tour? I mean, do you clump dates?
We try to do like a weekend if we can, but mostly it's going out to like we have Milwaukee in September, and then we have San Francisco in October. So I think we've got a couple of linked cities in I think Northampton and Connecticut in the fall. But check our website. Check cinematictitanic.com. It's got all the information that I don't remember.
Well, you don't have to. You got a website.
That's right.
Being in Minnesota, and are you near the Twin Cities or in one of them or something?
Yeah, I'm about an hour from Minneapolis.
That's all I know about Minnesota because I've been there. I've been to Minneapolis, and I've been to St. Paul. In the same day, I was in both.
Hard to do. They're so far apart.
They really are. But is there enough performance opportunity for you, or is it going to be writing, or what?
Well, primarily it's been writing. But there's a great production community in Minneapolis, and in fact, I'm working on a project right now that will shoot in August. I can't say too much about it at the moment, but Frank Conniff is in it, Josh, Mary Jo, Dave Gruber Allen, just to name a few folks. And it is a bit of a tribute to old movies, old horror movies. So I can say that about it. It's musical. And it'll be up on the web. It's just a one-off kind of test of whether or not I want to work hard or not.
Well, I've really enjoyed Frank Conniff's two podcasts that he's put up so far. He's done these musical.
Yeah, he does Podhouse 90.
Yeah,
he's done.
And they've both been funny as they can be. The first one was a political allegory kind of set in The Wizard of Oz.
The Pundits of Oz.
Yeah. And I just heard the second one.
South by South by Satan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which Dana Gould plays the Dark Lord.
Yes. A very Vincent Pricey kind of Satan, I thought.
Yes. Yes. A very mincing, Priceyan take. But yeah, Frank has written all of those, and Josh stars in South by South by Satan as well, and they're musical.
They're really elaborate. And,
yeah,
I mean, those are real. I mean, that's real scripted stuff.
Absolutely.
There's no iffy improv in that.
No.
And all those songs are terrific. It's just it's a really great idea.
Yeah, well, get the word out. He'd be thrilled that more people find those. And he's got a third one that he's working on. I don't know when that's coming out. But, you find them on iTunes. You can get them there.
I subscribe, so whenever the new one comes out, it just pops up on my iTunes. And
yeah.
Always glad to see it.
Well,
there's only two.
Yeah.
But I've been glad to see both of them.
Next time Frank's in Los Angeles, you should try to hook up and talk to him. You would love talking with Frank. He knows everything. Frank on Frank.
It would be a double Frank situation. And I would love to. I know that he and Jerry Beck, who's been a guest on my show, do the cartoon dump.
Yep.
And so I didn't realize, I asked Frank, I actually emailed him a long time ago to be on the podcast, and I never heard from him, the bum, but I didn't realize that he had moved out of town, just as I had not realized that you had moved out of town.
We're very sneaky.
Yeah, because I contacted Mike Pelleschi and said, do you know where Trace is? I'd like to ask him to be on the show. And then I had found you before he ever got around to answering me, so by the time you wrote back and said, I live in Minnesota.
Well, I'm glad that we could make this work out.
I am too.
I was in town to do Paul Feig's DVD commentary on The Heat. I must say that again.
Yes.
See it in theaters now. See it three times. And then when it comes out on Blu-ray, you can see our commentary track with Joel and Josh and I, the original Mystery Science Theater 3000 riffers.
That sounds
talkers,
like something
mockers.
Nobody can turn down.
Yeah, and it's a great movie.
Yeah. Well, The Bridesmaid was one of the funniest things I'd seen in years, and I really can't wait to see this one. I just, you know, it's hard for me to see the talkies all that often, but but I do get out there, so.
Well, you see more silent film. Now, you're going to this festival in San Francisco, right?
Yeah.
This weekend?
Yeah. It's next weekend, but I'm leaving tomorrow for the week, and I've just set up a whole bunch of podcast interviews for that.
What films
for the whole
will
week.
You see?
A lot of them that I've never heard of, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
But they are showing Harold Lloyd's Safety Last.
Awesome.
With the Mont Alto Orchestra. And there's a program of Winsor McKay animation, which, of course, I've seen them all a million times, but still never get tired of looking at them. And just a lot of some foreign silent films that I've never seen. So there'll be a lot of discoveries for me there. And the thing is, it's always fun. It's always great to be up there. It's at the Castro.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful theater.
Oh, yeah. We're playing there October 19th.
Ah.
We'll be at the Castro.
Yeah, great. And I'm going to be recording in the lounge. And so I've set up a whole bunch of interviews, but I'm just also going to be just looking at the crowd as they come out of the...
Mm-hmm.
And say, wait a minute. There's a film historian there.
Yeah.
Come here. And see if I can get some on the fly.
If people have not gone to the Castro and you live in San Francisco, if you're going there, go to the Castro.
Yeah.
It's
a beauty.
There are not a lot of those buildings left. And that one's stunning. The guy, the organist, comes out before the show and plays the organ,
mm-hmm.
which is the building. He plays the building.
Yeah.
And that alone is worth the price.
Yeah, it's a fight I feel like I'm losing. I'm John the Baptist crying in the wilderness here.
At least you're still in the wilderness. You're not on a plate yet.
Not yet. But at least that Salome is still going to... But, there are films, and I would say most films, just play better on a big screen in a theater. And to see it in a beautiful setting like that, and see a silent film with live music, especially mm-hmm. live orchestra, there's just nothing like it.
Yeah, that's... if you have the opportunity to see something the way it was meant to be done, it's... You're cheating yourself.
Last year, we were up in Oakland to see Napoleon. That's why Kevin was in town. And it was, 5.5 hours long, 70-piece orchestra in this incredible... It was the Paramount Theater in Oakland.
Mm.
And it was just an experience that I'll take to my grave. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And, when I got home, people kept saying, so are they going to put it out on Blu-ray? Or who cares if they are? Don't.
Yeah.
You don't want to watch it little. How stupid is that?
Yeah.
Because this thing is huge, It's
just... It's amazing with films that are that good, though, that going back to Lawrence of Arabia, I had it on a crummy VHS copy off television, and it's still a great movie. But then I got to see it projected the way it was supposed to be projected. First at the Cooper Theater in Minneapolis before they tore it down. And then when I moved to Los Angeles, they were showing it again at the Cinerama Dome.
Yeah.
And, you got to see those movies the way they were meant to be seen. The distance from the screen to the audience and the full effect of that is just amazing.
Yeah, next time they have one of those Cinerama festivals, you should come out for that in case you never saw Cinerama. Because that's just, it's indescribable. It's just this, complete peripheral vision. And so you're just immersed in this thing. It's just unlike anything you've ever experienced. And
yeah, it's not even like the 3D or the IMAX.
No.
It's, movies were big. They were great.
Yeah, don't watch them on your phones. That's all I'm saying. So, I really appreciate your coming out here to do this.
Oh,
it's been so much fun to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
And catch up on old times.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to do it again. I'm glad that we could fit it in before your trip.
Yeah, this is perfect timing. So it really works out well, and I'm delighted. I've really been looking forward to talking to you.
And I have too. I just you get to talk to these great film historians and filmmakers, and I'm so jealous that and it's great that
start coming along with me. That's fine.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'd love to.
Well, thanks a lot, Trace. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Frank.
I sure hope you enjoyed that conversation with Trace Beaulieu. I sure did. It's been a long time since I talked with him, and it was really fun getting together and reminiscing a bit and then talking about things that we've never talked about before. So that was great. Hope that I will see him again sooner than the last time. It took 15 years between visits this time, so let's try for 7 years, Trace. How about that? Thanks also to my wonderful wife, Claire McCullough, for being my announcer. Thanks to Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my theme music, which I love to listen to every week.
And thanks to James Hutchins for designing my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. I especially urge you to go to thecommentarytrack.com because there are several things I want you to do for me there, things that will benefit us both. First off, I want you to really seriously look into your heart and consider how many copies of the DVD of my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest, you want to buy. At first blush, you might want to buy one, but when you really think about it, you're going to want to buy 7 to 12, maybe even more. You have many, many friends who would really love to see this, so I urge you to buy multiple copies. And if nothing else, they look great stacked up on your shelf. So even if you don't have friends, and I know that all of my listeners have plenty of friends because they're likable people. I like you, and you like me, and that's why you want to buy my DVD, The Lost Remake of Beaugest. You can also go to the book page on thecommentarytrack.com and see my own books, and I hope that you'll consider buying some of those. If there's a price there, that means I have copies of the book, and I can autograph it for you. And I'd be happy to do that. Just enclose a little note when you pay for it. And if there's no price, if it just has an Amazon link, then that means I don't have copies. So you just use the link and go through Amazon and buy the book, and then I will get a little bit of a kickback. That goes for all of my guests on each of their pages. When you hit the details button on their front page, you'll see links to their books and videos and whatnot. And in the case of Trace, we'll have Mystery Science Theater videos up there and who knows what else. And I hope that you will buy those because the MSD3K shows watch them again and again. I mean, watch them again and again after you've ordered The Lost Remake of Beaugest. That's all I'm saying. There's a sequence to life, and this is the logical starting place to order my DVD and then to order things by other people. That's just the way things work, or should work, in my world. Again, I hope that you will go to iTunes and leave a nice review and a 5-star rating because I really want to help bring more people to this podcast. And that's the only way we can do it, that and word of mouth. If you would tell friends who are interested in film to listen, it's a free show and it's not doesn't take that much out of their lives to do it. And I think that people who are really interested in movies would really be interested in this show. So spread the word. I really appreciate it. And we got some good interviews coming up in the coming weeks. A lot of the people that I talked with in San Francisco and others, I've got a couple of pretty surprising interviews coming up too, including one that veers toward being off topic for this show, but I really enjoyed talking it over anyway. So you'll hear that when you hear it. In the meantime, don't you worry, I'll fix it in post.